coming to the library in 1986, Don McHugh brings an interesting perspective and a broad experience to curator of the Lincoln Memorial Shrine. In real life, his technique, are you trying to sandbag my head?
We've got to make absolutely certain he's going to come down.
Absolutely, don't blame me if this gets interrupted. Don is an alumnus of Claremont McKenna College. He then did his graduate work at Johns Hopkins University. He has worked for the federal government doing historical research involving World War II issues. He's had diverse also experience in the political field and in the halls of Washington, D.C.'s sausage-making machine known as public policy. He came to the Lincoln Memorial Shrine fired up with energy and interest and a perspective on various aspects of the Civil War, particularly those that are important about the process of the war itself and the people who prosecuted and fought valiantly for that endeavor. Don quickly took the reins of the operation and was part and parcel of the responsibility for expanding this organization in 1998 to this wonderful facility we have now. And at my personal request, I asked that this screen be designed in the original plan. I shouldn't have done it in light of the sandbagging that just took place on this introduction. Don also is the author of Treasures of the Lincoln Shrine. He serves as a member of the National Lincoln Forum and on its board, conducts the annual essay contest for students across America. This involves literally thousands of essays to coordinate and pass through and pass judgment on. He also is a very fine speaker on a number of subjects about Lincoln and the Civil War. His real title is Archivist and Head of Special Collections at Smiley Library, and the museum, the Lincoln Memorial Shrine, is what he serves as curator of. I'm pleased to say that the brains in the family is here, his wife Susan, and with that I turn it over to Don McHugh.
Thank you, everybody, and thank you for coming out on a great fall afternoon and sharing a little of your afternoon to help us celebrate Abraham Lincoln's bicentennial. As Larry mentioned, this is our fourth and final lecture of our series. They are available on podcast, and I think they've been a success in helping get the word out about Abraham Lincoln, our Lincoln Memorial Shrine, and exploring some parts of Abraham Lincoln that perhaps you don't see on a day-to-day basis. What I thought I'd do to finish up our bicentennial series is talk about what I call Lincoln's greatest decision. Now, those of you who received our Lincoln Memorial Association newsletter in the mail know what that decision is. It's the Emancipation Proclamation, so we can all go home, right? Right now. But now I want to examine the path to that Emancipation Proclamation and also take a look at some revisionist arguments that claim that Lincoln, at best, was a reluctant emancipator and really didn't have his heart in freeing slaves. So let's get started. All right, great emancipator or racist. Now, from our perspectives of the 21st century, it seems obvious that the Emancipation Proclamation was the way to go. But we have to put ourselves back into the mid-19th century. America was a greatly different place in the mid-19th century than it is today. And judge Lincoln against his time. One of these major sins that this gentleman right here, Lerone Bennett, is probably the best example of, is the sin of what I call presentism. Judging Lincoln by the standards of the 21st century and judging his actions of the 19th century against 21st century standards. Now, Lerone Bennett was the editor of Ebony Magazine, and he put out an article, Was Lincoln a White Supremacist, in 1968. And then he percolated his ideas for the better part of 30 years, and then published this 500-plus page screed called Force and Glory, Abraham Lincoln's White Dream, about 10 years ago. And it really kind of upset the apple cart in the Lincoln community, because it took a lot of Lincoln quotes that I'll be examining here in a second, and in my view, took them out of context or failed to present the opposite side of some of those same quotes, in trying to present the argument that Lincoln was a closet racist, or not even a closet racist, and out of a closet racist, and really had to be dragged, kicking and screaming, into giving the Emancipation Proclamation. All right, well, let's take a look at Lincoln's words about slavery. Now, it's quite clear from he would later write in his campaign biography in 1860 that from his earliest memory, he was anti-slavery. Some three quotes that really sum up his case. If slavery is not wrong, nothing is wrong. As I would not be a slave, so I also would not be a master. Whenever I hear anyone arguing for slavery, I feel a strong impulse to see it tried on him personally. Now this Ossendorf drawing here is a depiction of Lincoln witnessing a slave auction on his trip to New Orleans, where they took his young man, in which he saw slavery up close and personal and developed an antipathy towards it. Now, what we have to remember is Lincoln's personal antipathy towards slavery would not get in the way of what he viewed his official position when he was later president, and as a politician, what he felt he could achieve as a politician. He may be opposed to slavery, but in his view, he couldn't immediately take steps to overturn slavery because it was recognized in the U.S. Constitution, of course. Now, I'm going to fast forward to the 1850s here. Lincoln's own personal antipathy towards slavery did not stop him, for example, in that famous case in 1847, representing a Kentucky slave owner named Maxon, who took his slaves to Illinois and attempted via convoluted reasoning to argue that he had the right to keep his slaves in Illinois for a brief period of time. The courts ruled against him. Maxon went to Lincoln asking for help. Lincoln pressed the case, was unsuccessful, and the slaves were liberated. But scholars and authors like Lerone Bennett see upon this as an example that Lincoln really wasn't committed against slavery. If you were anti-slavery, how could you represent a slaveholder in a famous case? Other examples that Bennett and others take against Lincoln are the famous Fugitive Slave Law of 1850. This galvanized opposition in the North to attempts to bring freed slaves back to the South. Police were authorized to round up freed slaves in the free states, and as a result, in numerous cases, they'd actually take free men of color and arrest them and take them back south. It was an instigation to the people in the North that these slave catchers were roaming the free states of the North and arresting people and those who would assist the freed slaves. Lincoln supported the Fugitive Slave Law and took a lot of flack for that fact. He supported the Black Codes in Illinois. These were Jim Crow later type of legislation that would attempt to prescribed the civil rights of African Americans. He supported those in Illinois, as did the majority of Illinois senators and politicians. So people point to some of the things that Lincoln did earlier in his career to say that he was not an egalitarian. All right, now what turned Lincoln around or re-galvanized his political enthusiasm was the passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act in 1854. Basically what it did is overturn the Missouri Compromise, which settled the issue of slavery's extension into the new territories, the new states of the West, when we gain a lot of states as a result of the Mexican-American War. This Kansas-Nebraska Act overturned the compromise that slavery would be prescribed above a certain geographical line. The dream and inspiration of Stephen Douglas, it tore open the issue of slavery, because if the people in an individual territory or a newly formed state could make the decision for themselves, in Lincoln's view, nothing would stop slavery from being reinstituted in the free states of the North, if a majority could be convinced at some time to reinstitute slavery. So he felt that he had to be galvanized to stop this Kansas-Nebraska Act doctrine of popular sovereignty from allowing slavery to be decided up and down, stop the slavery from being extended into the territories. This became the driving essence of Lincoln's political being and what motivated him in the 1850 period. Now this is an illustration here, Freer and Hodge illustration, showing a free soiler. Lincoln was a free soiler in 1854. This is not Lincoln. It looks a little like him, but of course he didn't have the beard in 1854. Being forced to swallow an African-American representation that slavery is being forced down the throats of the white people, the white settlers in the North. All right. Lincoln rose to political prominence in 1858, of course. His House Divided speech, the key line in that speech, of course, is a house divided against itself cannot stand. This nation is either going to be all slave or all free at some point in the future. Now that brought him to the attention of the newly forming Republican Party and made him a rising star in that party. But also, these words would later hound him when he became president, because it convinced those in the South that Lincoln's protestations that he was really interested in just stopping the spread of slavery into the new states were lies, and that based on the House Divided speech, he was really intending to do away with slavery, the exact opposite of what the Lerone Bennett of the world will have to believe. All right, the Lincoln-Douglas debates of 1858. Now, we have to remember, Illinois was a far from racially enlightened place in 1858. Lincoln is attempting to run for Senate at that time. Remember, the legislator chooses the senators back then. But it's still a popular campaign to try to get support. His opponent, Stephen Douglas, a Democrat, baited Lincoln throughout the campaign about Lincoln's racial views. He claimed that Lincoln was in favor of what they called miscegenation, which is a basic a way of saying race mixing. It was in favor of interracial marriage. And Douglas baited Lincoln throughout the campaign. So in the Charlestown debate, the sixth of the seven debates, Lincoln was forced to give a riposte to these accusations on Douglas's part because they were scoring points among the Illinois populace. Lincoln responded, "I will say that I am not, nor have ever been, in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the white and black races. That I am not, nor have ever been, in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. And I will say, in addition to that, there is a physical difference between the white and black races, which I will believe will forever forbid the two races living together on terms of social and political equality. And inasmuch as they so live, while they do remain together, there must be a position of superior and inferior. And I, as much as any other man, am in favor of having the superior position assigned to the white race." Now, I had my administrative assistant, some of you know, of course, Misty Moore, type up these remarks here, and she typed them up blind and didn't know who that statement was coming from. And she thought it was from a white supremacist or a Klan member today. But it's Abraham Lincoln in 1858. Now, remember, we're going to see some growth in Lincoln's viewpoints. Now, what Bennett and some of the others failed to do, in my view, is modify this Charleston debate statement here, which on the face of it is really quite racist. He fails to modify it with the statement he would make later at the second debate in Alton by saying, "The Negro may not be my equal in all respects, perhaps not in intelligence, certainly not in color, but in his natural right to eat the bread which he earns with his own hand, he is my equal and the equal of all others." So Lincoln's ideas of opposition to slavery was based largely on this idea of the right of labor, the right of free labor, that every man should have the right to earn the bread that he makes with his own hand. Now, neither he nor the, I'd say, 97, 98, 99% of the people in Illinois in 1858 were ready at that point to envision a multiracial democracy with full equal rights for all. So judging Lincoln against the standards of today, as I pointed out earlier, I think is a disservice to his memory. But these statements still are on the record. Now, of course, Lincoln lost that campaign in 1858, but he rose to prominence as a result of his utterances and won the Republican nomination in 1860. Now, an important thing for us to remember is that it was only as a result of a split in the Democratic Party that Lincoln and these, as they call them in the South, black Republicans were able to gain electoral triumph. You can see here in this map, Lincoln's in orange. The Democratic Party split in two. Breckinridge, the Southern candidate, swept the Southern states. Stephen Douglas, Lincoln's 1858 opponent, was the candidate of the Northern Democrats, and he barely won a few districts in Illinois, Minnesota as well, carried very few electoral votes. The split in the Democratic Party allowed Lincoln and the Republicans with 40% of the popular vote to secure an overwhelming amount of electoral college votes, and as a result, he was elected. An important factor to remember, because he probably would not have been elected if the Democrats hadn't split over this issue of the extension of slavery into the territories. One brief little aside here. I thought it was interesting that Sam Reading County here will note went pro-Lincoln in 1860 while the rest of California was a Breckinridge, Southern California, pro-Lincoln. All right. Now, I don't see any of our Southern veterans. Steve Madden's not here. Our Confederate veteran friends aren't here this afternoon. But I sometimes get into heated debates with them about what the Civil War is all about. Now, we're usually on the same page by saying the Civil War was about secession. The South seceded. These states here in the bottom here, seven deep South states, upon the election of Abraham Lincoln, began a secession process. Now, where I part ways with my Southern friends, or my Southern advocate friends, is why the South seceded. To me, it's clear about Abraham Lincoln. It was his election that sparked their secession. Now, why his election? It was their fears about what he was going to do about slavery. That even if they could take him on his word about stopping the extension of slavery into the new territories, they were still fearful he would go back against his word and somehow engineer the repeal of slavery in the southern states. So it's Lincoln's election that sparks that secession movement. Now, an important thing to recall here is up to the Lincoln's inauguration, only the deep South states seceded, and then you've got these upper tier of four middle tier southern states that would secede after the firing upon Fort Sumter. And also of importance are the four border slave-holding states of the North. We're going to be talking about them in a little bit more detail. The four slave-holding states of the North that remain loyal to the Union. Lincoln has to keep this under consideration throughout his judgment as to when and where to issue an Emancipation Proclamation. All right, the war breaks out, and he's under immediate pressure from the abolitionists, and here are some of the more famous names, to immediately emancipate the slaves as a war measure to help win this civil war. Lincoln demurs. In his view, those border states that we just saw, if they're forced into making a choice between keeping their slaves and keeping in the Union, he believes they'll go south. So he resists this pressure from the abolitionists at the beginning of the war to free the slaves immediately. Now, people like Bennett and some of his defenders claim that the war could have been ended right from the start if Lincoln would have emancipated the slaves right from the beginning. And to me, that seems fallacious, especially if you've been to Kentucky or Maryland or Delaware or Missouri, especially in 1861. I think an immediate emancipation would have clearly driven them into the arms of the Confederacy. And again, you can see from the map here some of that challenge. Maryland, for example, surrounds the District of Columbia, Missouri, a key state in the West, and Kentucky occupies a crucial position in the center. Geostrategically, the border states were key. Lincoln had to consider their opinion in deciding whether or not to issue an emancipation. All right, the war is barely a month old before issues start to heat up and Lincoln is forced to confront the problem of slavery. Now, this attractive gentleman here is Benjamin the Beast Butler. He was nicknamed the Beast not because of his eye issues, but because of his harsh treatment of the Northern civilians in 1862. He's down at Fortress Monroe, which is near Norfolk, Virginia, a federal installation that remains under federal control. Sumter, of course, is surrendered to the Confederacy. Fortress Monroe stays under Union control. Slaves from surrounding plantations flock to Fortress Monroe, seeking their freedom. What's to be done with them? The first handful of slaves, Butler returns to their slaveholding masters. They get a truce. To declare the battle over for a moment, the slaves are escorted through the lines and returned to their slaveholding masters. Now, as more and more come in, Butler realizes this seems to be foolish. In his mind, he comes up with this unique idea, declaring these runaway slaves as contraband of war, a phrase that can refer to anything that's seized in wartime, be it horses, equipment, farms, contraband, things that are seized. He declares the slaves contraband of war, and begins to give them protection. Now, this issue causes Congress to take a look at this larger issue. What are we going to do with these slaves? Lincoln, at this point, wants these slaves returned to their slave owners because of his fear of what it's going to do to those border states. Now, Congress lights a fire under Lincoln. They push him a little farther than he wanted to go initially. This senator here was the senator from Illinois, Lyman Trumbull. And he passed, or managed to get through Congress, the first Confiscation Act in August of 1861. Now, this Confiscation Act authorized the military to seize the slaves that were being used for military purposes in the southern states. Now, we have a manuscript that's in our case over here. That's a receipt that the southern states gave to slaveholders for their slaves being used to dig trenches and military fortifications. Now, this was the smoking gun, if you will, that Abraham Lincoln used and Congress used before him to kind of push matters along. Here was proof that the South was using slaves for military purposes. Now, in Lincoln's view, his interpretation of the Constitution, he had the ability as Commander-in-Chief to influence military events. So this first step towards emancipation is this first Confiscation Act, that only affects the slaves that are being used for military purposes. All right, we move on a little bit further in time. The war isn't going well. We've already had the first Bull Run. There's Wilson's Creek out in Missouri at this time. Missouri, this border state, has plenty of slave-holding loyal Union members and also plenty of Confederate supporting members. It's almost an internal war. The closest we get to a real internecine, typical civil war in which brother is against brother is in the state of Missouri. It's a nasty business. Fremont declares martial law, and to weaken the slaveholders in the state, he declares a statewide emancipation in September of 1861. Lincoln doesn't like this idea, and I'll give you his reasoning. I think there is great danger that the confiscation of the property and the liberating of slaves of traitorous owners will alarm our southern Union friends and turn them against us, perhaps ruin a rather fair prospect for Kentucky. I think to lose Kentucky is nearly the same as to lose the whole game, he could later write. Kentucky gone, we cannot hold Missouri, nor I think Maryland. These against us all, and the job on our hands is too large for us. We would as well consent to separation at once, including the surrender of this capital. So Lincoln rescinds John C. Fremont's emancipation in Missouri. Fremont actually forces him to do so, says he will not do so without written authorization, and he does. This, as you might imagine, picks off Abraham Lincoln, and he resolves whenever he has the opportunity to make sure that Fremont's career is stalled militarily, and he would do so about a year later. But the important thing to remember is there's an early attempt at emancipation. Lincoln believes the timing is not right because of the impact it would have on the border states rescinded. All right, the war continues for a couple of months. His Secretary of War, the notorious Simon Cameron, known more for his corruption and his incompetency, in December of 1861, he gives his annual message to Congress, and he advocates using black troops, using freed slaves as black troops. Lincoln is very angry about this. He demands that the proclamation be retracted, and it is retracted, and then he responds by sending Simon Cameron as ambassador to St. Petersburg in Russia, about as far away as he can possibly go. He barely makes it there a couple months before he comes back, another part of our story. The important part is that in Lincoln's view, that the time for emancipation is not yet ripe. December of 1861, by the way, is in the midst of also the Trent Affair with Great Britain. We almost get into war with Great Britain at the same time. Lincoln would say one war at a time. So in his view, the time is not right to take this radical step of emancipation. All right, well, we go further into 1862. Congress, again, trying to goad Lincoln, the radical Republicans in Congress, goad Lincoln and taking further steps, comes up with a bill authorizing the immediate emancipation of the 3,000 slaves in the District of Columbia. Now, this is what they call compensated emancipation. Each slave owner is to get $300 for their slave. If you do math, it's $9,000, good chunk of money back then, but the slaves were compensated. Lincoln begins to put out the word that he would consider this compensated emancipation as something for the border states, tries to get some support for it in Delaware, Missouri, Maryland, and Kentucky. Those states, the legislators in those states, said, no dice, we're not interested. Lincoln's attempts to get compensated emancipation did not succeed. The bill also includes money for colonization, and we'll talk about that in just a second. All right, May of 1862. General David Hunter here, interesting character, we're going to talk about him, but kills three men in duels, gets kicked out of West Point, John Quincy Adams gets him reinstated, tells Lincoln there's a plot against him in Baltimore on the way into Washington, D.C. during the pre-inaugural period, comes on his own volition on the train, organizes a security detail, Lincoln is beholden to him, he helps get him a brigadier generalship in the volunteers. And later on, he would be the judge advocate of the trial of the conspirators in 1865, with try those who attempted to conspire to kill Lincoln. So an interesting guy. May of 1862, he's in charge of what they call the Department of the South. There have been a series of amphibious invasions, small but important, that the Union had launched at positions along the southeastern seaboard, near Savannah, near Charleston, near Roanoke, Virginia. And they've established little amphibious beachheads and freed slaves that had run away from their plantations, slaves attempting to get freedom, would flock to these Union enclaves. Hunter, wondering what to do with these men, decides on his own volition to authorize an emancipation proclamation for the areas that he's in control of, and come up with the idea of giving these soldiers pipes, like John Brown gave to the Harper's Ferry rebels. So in the first steps towards military use of the slaves, Lincoln, when he finds out about this, is not pleased. I, Abraham Lincoln, President of the United States, proclaim and declare that the government of the United States had no knowledge, information, or belief of an intention on the part of General Hunter to issue such a proclamation, nor has it yet any authentic information that the document is genuine, and further, that neither General Hunter nor any other commander or person has been authorized by the government of the United States to make proclamations declaring the slaves of any state free, and that the supposed proclamation, now in question, whether genuine or false, is altogether void. Oh, the fancy graphics here are courtesy of Dr. Jeff Smith. I further make known that whether it be competent for me as Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy to declare the slaves of any state or states free, and whether at any time, in any case, it shall become a necessity indispensable to the maintenance of the government to exercise such supposed power, are questions which, under my responsibility, I reserve to myself, and which I cannot feel justified in leaving to the decision of commanders in the field. Now, important point here. He's not saying that the emancipation is a bad idea, but I want to make the decision for myself. And we'll see that with some of his jostling with Congress in 1862. He believes constitutionally that power has to come from the chief executive, not from Congress and not from individual military commanders. As part of his further rescinding of this Hunter emancipation, he goes on to try to convince the border states again to opt voluntarily for compensated emancipation. Talks about how Congress has made compensated emancipation an official argument of theirs. He appeals to the people of the border states. "Do you now earnestly appeal? I do not argue. I beseech you to make the arguments for yourself. You cannot, if you would be blind to the signs of the times. I beg of you a calm and enlarged consideration of them, ranging, if it may be, far above personal and partisan policies. This proposal makes common sense, for a common object, casting no reproaches upon any. The change it contemplates would come gently as the dews of heaven, not rending or wrecking anything. Will you not embrace it? So much good has not been done by one effort in past time, as in the providence of God, as it is now your privilege to do. May the vast future not have to lament that you neglected to do it." Again, he's trying to push this issue of this idea of compensated emancipation, voluntary compensated emancipation. Now, why is he big on the compensation? There's obviously a financial interest in slavery that he's trying to undercut the support for it in the border states. And he's also concerned about what's to become of the post-emancipation period. All right, you can see as he's moving towards compensated emancipation, he starts telling confidants that he's considering issuing, under his military powers as commander-in-chief, an emancipation proclamation. The first, the claim that Lincoln came up to him and said, "I'm going to emancipate the slaves," was Senator John Henderson of Missouri. Now, the document claiming this was discovered a couple of years ago by Michael Burlingame, who came out here and spoke a few years back, and he's kind of the expert at digging up minutia. I personally don't think the evidence is compelling that Henderson had this conversation in May of 1862. Stronger is in June of 1862, Vice President Hannibal Hamlin claims that Lincoln came to him and said, "I'm seriously considering issuing an emancipation," yet he did not do so. So is Hamlin telling the truth? Probably so, but Lincoln may have been percolating the idea that coming to the decision was a little more difficult. What drove Lincoln to deciding that the time was right was military affairs. And this is, I'll go off on a side little tangent here, kind of one thing that little bugs me a little bit about the school classes that we have that come in from the University of Redlands, Cal State San Bernardino, and others. They seem to want to ignore the military aspect of the Civil War. Because in my view, the military component is crucial to making the political decisions, including the greatest decision, the emancipation. The military component is vital. Now, for someone to get through a Civil War class, and I won't name the institution that did, but to not have any knowledge of George McClellan, the Harrison's Landing, 7 Days Campaign, or the Battle of Antietam, I'm just appalled that they're not able to make those connections. Because the important issues are decided on the battlefield and drive Lincoln to make those decisions that we justly honor him for. 7 Days Campaign, that's George McClellan's attempt to capture Richmond in June of 1862, see him there. Short version, it was a failure. 7 days worth of campaigning. The Union Army, which is in blue here, is forced away from Richmond by Robert E. Lee's Confederates. They're undermanned, but thanks to McClellan's military incompetence, they're pushed back day by day by day by day, forced all the way back to Harrison's Landing here, and forming a fortified base that the Confederates can't throw them out. But this is a military disaster for the Union. Hopes were raised very high that McClellan's campaign would capture Richmond and end the rebellion right then and there. So instead, over the span of a week, to have Union forces completely reversed and thrown back to the James River here was a major blow to Union morale. Lincoln was devastated by this news. He wanted to go, and did go, to Harrison's Landing here to interview McClellan directly to see what was going on with the war effort. Now, again, we could do a whole other presentation on George McClellan and his strange personality and his key role in the American Civil War. But suffice it to say that McClellan takes the opportunity to give Lincoln a letter when he meets him in July 7, 1862, giving him advice about how the war is to be run. Now, usually successful generals sort of get to tell the president how the war is to be run, not unsuccessful generals. Now, let me read you a chunk of that letter. First of all, he starts by saying, "I cannot but regard our condition as critical. I may be on the brink of eternity." Now, little overdramatic. In other words, that the Confederates may overwhelm their camp. Now, remember, this is the president's there as well, so he's on the brink of eternity, so is the president at the same time. The time has come when our government must determine upon a civil and military policy. The rebellion has assumed the character of a war. Now, that must have 15 months in. What was it before that? Just the rebellion? And then he gives some advice about the war should be prosecuted on the highest principles known to Christian civilization. It should not be a war looking to the subjugation of any people or any state. Then he goes on to say, neither confiscation of property, political executions of persons, territorial organizations of states, or forcing abolition of slavery should be contemplated for a moment. Military power should not be allowed to interfere with the relations of servitude, either by supporting or impairing the authority of the masters. Finally, a declaration of radical views, especially upon slavery, will rapidly disintegrate our armies. So here's a losing general who's just lost his key campaign telling Lincoln, do not take any radical steps upon freeing the slaves, because it's going to dissolve our armies. Lincoln takes this advice in silence, but in my view and the view of many other scholars, determines that, one, McClellan's not the man for the Army of the Potomac this time, and two, but more importantly, an Emancipation Proclamation is going to be necessary that strictly controls emancipation to impact the South's military abilities, thanks to this setback at the Seven Days Campaign in the peninsula in Virginia. Congress has their own intentions. They go forward and pass a second Confiscation Act. This is Thaddeus Stevens here. You can see by that scowl on his face, he's known as a tough character. He passes through Congress the second Confiscation Act. Now, this second act goes a little bit further. Remember, the first one only authorized the seizure of slaves that were being directly used for military purposes. The second act authorizes the seizure of any slave of anyone in a rebelling state who is disloyal to the Union government. Now, there's supposed to be courts set up to determine this disloyalty. Now, how you set up a court in the middle of wartime is a tough proposition, but this has not stopped the radicals in Congress from lighting a fire under Lincoln. Now, Lerone Bennett and others claim it's really the Second Confiscation Act that is should get more of the credit for freeing the slaves, not the Emancipation Proclamation. I think that's going too far, but it is part of the story, because it does push Lincoln in that direction a little bit further. All right, having come back immediately from Harrison's Landing, Second Confiscation Act, which Lincoln opposed because he did not think Congress had the authority to do what it did, and also saw problems with the implementation of this court system, forces Lincoln's hand. July 22, 1862, at a cabinet meeting, he announces to the cabinet that he's decided upon an Emancipation Proclamation and wants to issue it immediately. Now, the cabinet, and particularly William Seward here, makes modifications in the proclamation, and Seward in particular says to issue the proclamation now would seem like the last shriek on the road to defeat, and it would be our arms reaching out to Ethiopia, as he called it, the slaves, rather than Ethiopia reaching out to us. So Seward convinces Lincoln to wait to the appropriate time after a military victory before issuing that Emancipation Proclamation. Lincoln realizes, however, that there are going to be problems with this Emancipation Proclamation in the border states. That same argument that's been going on for 15 months still applies. So what is he going to do to try to pull the teeth of opposition of those in the North to the Emancipation? Now, the first thing he works on doing is trying to convince African Americans in the United States to think about colonization. Now, again, controversial from today's point of view, but it was a movement that had a long history in the United States, and we continue all the way up into the early 20th century, the idea that African Americans could not successfully integrate into the United States, and for the purpose of justice and for their benefit, should return to their origin in Africa, controversial by today's standards. But there were plenty of African Americans who did support this movement, including one of the sons of Frederick Douglass, and then later on in the late 19th century, Marcus Garvey, of course. Now, Lincoln met with a delegation of African Americans, ministers and others, in the White House. This is the first meeting, a large meeting, of a delegation of African Americans in the White House, so should get some credit for that. But some of the language he used in that meeting, it was recorded by a reporter that day, again, sounds a little bit harsh to our ears. I do not propose to discuss this, but to present it as fact with which we have to deal. I cannot alter it if I would. I need not recount to you the effects upon white men growing out of the institutions of slavery. I believe in its general evil effects on the entire white race. See our present condition, the country engaged in war. Are white men cutting each other's throats, none knowing how far it will extend? and then consider what we know to be the truth. But for your race among us, there could not be war, although many men engaged on either side do not care for you one way or the other. Nevertheless, I repeat, without the institution of slavery and the colored race as a basis, the war could not have an existence. It is better for us, therefore, to be separated. I know that there are free men among you who, even if they could better their condition, are not as much inclined to go out of the country as those who, being slaves, could obtain their freedom on this condition. I suppose one of the principal difficulties in the way of colonization is that the free colored man cannot see that his comfort would be advanced by it. You may believe you can live in Washington or elsewhere in the United States the remainder of your life as easily, perhaps, more so than you can in a foreign country, and hence you may come to the conclusion that you have nothing to the idea with the idea of going to a foreign country. This, and I speak in an unkind sense, is an extremely selfish view of the case. You ought to do something to help those who are not so fortunate as yourself. There is an unwillingness on the part of our people, harsh as it may be, for you free colored people to remain with us. Now, if you could give a start to white people, you would open a door wide for many to be made free. If we deal with those who are not free at the beginning and whose intellect are clouded by slavery, we have very poor materials to start with. If intelligent colored men, such as are here before me, would move in this matter, much might be accomplished. It is exceedingly important that we have men at the beginning capable of thinking as white men, and not those who have been systematically oppressed. There is much to encourage you. For the sake of your race, you should sacrifice something of your present comfort. And remember, these are free men of color that he's trying to convince to serve as an example to recolonize. Now, historians debate to this day how committed Abraham Lincoln was to colonization. Clearly, in 1862, he seems committed to it. Get ahead of the game a little bit, there are efforts at colonization. One of the ministers there recruits upwards of 16,000 men, make a commitment to colonize, not in Africa. Initially, they wanted to go to Panama. Instead, they settle upon Haiti. And in 1863, they do set up a colony in Haiti, and it turns into a disaster. Dozens die, and the attempt fails, and they come back to the United States. Lincoln's defenders claim that Lincoln really doesn't have his heart in colonization, but is using this as a fig leaf to get white support, particularly white racist support, in the border states for emancipation. He can respond to the arguments of those who say we're not ready for a multiracial democracy by saying, no, we're going to voluntarily encourage the freed slaves to return either to Africa, Panama, or Haiti. Again, quite controversial. The colonization idea, Lincoln would keep that idea up until at least 1864, early of 1864, and by then you stop seeing him mention it altogether. Again, I tend to feel that he, in the early stages, he's using it as an opportunity to try to eliminate white opposition to the emancipation. All right. Just a few days after that, Horace Greeley, the abolitionist leader of the New York Tribune newspaper, editor of the newspaper, publishes his famous Prayer of the 20,000, an editorial trying to push Lincoln into emancipating the slaves immediately. Remember, he's got a signed emancipation proclamation ready to go at this point. He's had it for an entire month, but he's waiting on the proper moment. So Greeley tries to push Lincoln into issuing that emancipation proclamation. Some of Greeley's language: "We think you are strangely and disastrously remiss in the discharge of your official and imperative duty with regard to the emancipation provisions of the new Confiscation Act. Those provisions were designed to fight slavery with liberty. They prescribe that men loyal to the Union and willing to shed their blood on her behalf shall no longer be held, with the nation's consent, in bondage to persistent, malignant traitors who for 20 years have been plotting and for 16 months have been fighting to divide and destroy our country. Why these traitors should be treated with tenderness by you, to the prejudice and the dearest rights of loyal men, we cannot conceive." Remember, when you're hearing this next language that's about to come up, that Greeley's an abolitionist. He's to the left, if you will, of Lincoln on the issue. Yet he's still not disinclined to use language that today we might consider to be racially insensitive. "As we advance, thousands of Southerners sift through our lines and make for Washington. They are blacker than you and I, perhaps, and they creep timidly, as if they doubt whether safer at the muzzle of the breech or Union muskets. But they come sincerely willing to be our friends if we will let them. Many of these are stalwart fellows, with muscles aching for something to do, and the nation aches for defenders. Why may not that and these here and now make a bargain? Why coddle an insane whim any longer when 300 lives a day is the price? The Negroes here have the muscle and can stand this exposure. Their lives are not very valuable to the world. They are densely, fearfully ignorant as the white citizens here almost, except perhaps in political matters. Why not let them fight for their native land and oblige them to, if it comes to that? Pennsylvania father, your son has been fighting for a year and is tired. He wants to come home and rest. Have you any objection to his accepting a sable substitute, the only accessible? Or will you insist that he shall still wear out his life as a substitute for Sambo? Michigan mother, your son will be drafted next week. Have you any objection to a Negro taking the musket and leaving him with you? If we were drowning or our house were burning, none of us would decline anybody's assistance. We may not be drowning, or we may be. At least we are in fearfully deep water. Shall we punctiliously refuse to grasp the pro-offered rope till we make sure that the hand that holds the other end is of orthodox complexion? Shame on our national foolhardiness. Must we be thrashed into common sense? When shall we learn the two simple lessons? First, that tolerance of treason anywhere is treason to loyalty everywhere. And second, in the language of the Tribune, to treat henceforward all unionists as if they were white men and all rebels as if they were anners. And he uses the real word in that concluding sentence. So again, harsh language, and this is coming from a man to Lincoln's left. But still the issue he's trying to point out, he's trying to convince white men that it's in their interest to be in favor of emancipation, and particularly to be in favor of the use of black soldiers as part of that. Lincoln responds a couple days later, and this is a famous quotation I'm sure most of you have heard. He responds, "I would save the Union. I would save it the shortest way under the Constitution. The sooner the national authority can be restored, the nearer the Union will be the Union as it was. If there will be those who would not save the Union unless they could at the same time save slavery, I do not agree with them. If there be those that would not save the Union unless they could at the same time destroy slavery, I do not agree with them. My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union, and is not either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. If I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could do it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that. What I do about slavery and the colored race, I do because I believe it helps save this Union. And what I forbear because I do not believe it would help us save the Union. I shall do less whenever I shall believe what I'm doing hurts the cause, and I shall do more whenever I believe what I'm doing helps the cause. I shall try to correct errors when they're shown to be errors, and I shall adopt new views so fast as they shall appear to be true views." Now, a lot of historians stop right there, Bennett does as well, and leaves off this important last sentence. "I have here stated my purpose according to my official duty, and I intend no modification of my oft-expressed personal wish that all men everywhere could be free." Again, he feels bound by his constitutional oath as to what he can accomplish constitutionally within his war powers as Commander-in-Chief. All right, the war, almost on a day-by-day basis, is changing momentarily. This phase of the war, Lee's invasion of Maryland in September 1862, is, in my view, the turning point, the key time in the American Civil War because of its impact on the emancipation, which you'll see here in a moment. Lee crosses into Maryland on September 4th. The campaign is underway. The battle in Antietam would take place on September 17th. So the issue is in doubt, and a group of Chicago ministers comes to Lincoln and tries to put pressure on him to emancipate the slaves. Lincoln responds back to them, and again there's a reporter recording his notes. "What good would a proclamation of emancipation do for me now as we are so situated? I do not want to issue a document that the whole world must necessarily be inoperative, like the Pope's bull against the comet. When my word free the slaves, when I cannot even enforce the Constitution in the rebel states? I admit that slavery is the root of this rebellion, or at least its sine qua non. The ambition of politicians may have instigated them to act, but they would have been impotent without slavery as their instrument. I also concede that emancipation would help us in Europe in convincing them that we are incited by something other than ambition. I grant further that it would help somewhat in the North, though not so much, I fear, as you and those who represent you imagine. Still, some additional strength would be added in that way to the war. And then, unquestionably, it would weaken the rebels by drawing off their laborers, which is, of course, of great importance. But I'm not so sure as what we could do with the blacks. If we were to arm them, I fear that in a few weeks, arms would be in the hands of the rebels. And indeed, thus far, we have not had arms enough to equip our white troops. I will mention another thing, though it may meet only your scorn and contempt. There are 50,000 bayonets in the Union armies from the border states. It would be a serious matter, and in consequence of a proclamation such as you desire, they should go over to the rebels. I do not think they all would, not so many indeed as a year ago, or 6 months ago, not so many today as yesterday. Still, it needs to be considered." So Again, despite the fact he's got this emancipation signed and ready to go, he's still reluctant to use it. Now, Lincoln, in my view, is keeping all his cards on the table, keeping the options open, colonization, compensated emancipation, and waiting for the right moment, despite these protestations that, in the face of things, don't look as good as they would if you from a distance. All right, September 17th, 1862. The Battle of Antietam is fought. It's a tactical draw, but McClellan is successful in forcing Lee's armies out of Maryland and back into Virginia. Lincoln would record that he told one of Secretary Stoddard that he promised God if our arms were successful in repelling Lee across the Potomac, that he would issue his emancipation. So a direct effect of the Battle of Antietam is the victory that Lincoln needs, and also this pact that Lincoln, who's not known for being overly religious and claiming upon God's guidance, in this case makes a statement, if you believe Stoddard, that he promised God that he would issue that Emancipation Proclamation if Union arms were successful in Antietam, and of course they were. 5 days after the battle, it takes until September 20th before Lincoln receives word from the reluctant McClellan that the victory has been achieved, partial victory. He really should have bagged the entire rebel army, but we won't talk about that today. The partial victory, Lincoln issues that preliminary Emancipation Proclamation. Now, a couple of important things to remember. First of all, the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation is a 100-day threat. September 22nd is exactly 100 days from January 1st, 1863. Lincoln puts the South on notice that their slaves, only the slaves in the southern states, will be affected, that if you do not return to the Union in 100 days, your slaves will be free. Also included in that provisional preliminary Emancipation Proclamation are language about colonization, advocating colonization for the freed slaves. There's also language in there about compensated emancipation and paying the slaveholders for their slaves. Specifically precluded in the emancipation, the preliminary version, are the slaves of the border states, those loyal border states, slaves of Tennessee, and other regions we'll talk about in the final version of the proclamation. So it's a limited gesture, a limited document, strictly within his wartime powers. Again, at this point, it's a 100-day threat. Come back, or this proclamation is going to be issued. All right, the reaction in the North, at least by Democrats in the North, is extremely unfavorable. And the best way of seeing that unfavorable reaction are the congressional elections in October and November of 1862. The Democrats gained 28 seats. Remember, they lost a good deal of their representation when the southern states seceded from the Union. So 28 seats in the North go to the Democrats in the House of Representatives. The governors, two governors, New Jersey and New York, go from Republican to Democrat. And state legislatures in Illinois and Indiana also gets controlled by the Democrats, and the state government is crucial in raising troops. So this is a major military setback for Lincoln. So he's rebuked in the way of phrasing it. The emancipation is political poison for the Republican Party in the fall of 1862. And there are plenty of people who tell him, you've got it rescinded. Do not issue this final version in January. Don't go forward with it. Lincoln doesn't listen to them. December 1st, 1862, Lincoln gives his annual message to Congress, and he proposes a 13th Amendment that would compensate emancipation, would free the slaves, but only gradually. It's going to take all the way up to 1900, and all slaveholders will be compensated for their slaves. And he implores the border states in particular to take up this idea of compensated emancipation. The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must wise with the occasion. As our case is new, so must we think anew, must act anew. We must disenthrall ourselves, and then we shall save our country. Fellow citizens, we cannot escape history. We of this Congress and this administration will be remembered in spite of ourselves. No personal significance or insignificance can spare one or another of us. The fiery trial through which we pass will light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation. We say we are for the Union. The world will not forget that we say this. We know how to save the Union. The world knows that we know how to save it. We, even we here in Congress, hold the power and bear the responsibility. In giving to the slave, we assure freedom to the free. In giving freedom to the slave, we assure freedom to the free. Honorable life in what we give and what we preserve. we shall nobly save or meanly lose the last best hope of earth. Now, in this time period, again, military events intercede. A few days, a week or so after this pronouncement, the new leader of the Army of the Potomac, Ambrose Burnside, leads the Union Army into disaster at Fredericksburg. It's probably the worst Union defeat of the war. Lincoln is plunged into a depression. We call it a melancholia, but it was depression. The war is going very poorly. Enlistments are dropping down, recruitment. The Militia Act of 1862 authorized conscription. It appears quite obvious that conscription is going to be required if we're going to meet the military manpower needs for the remainder of the war. Despite this, Lincoln holds firm to his announcement in this message, offering compensated emancipation. All right. A couple weeks transpired, January 1st, 1863. Lincoln, despite the protestations of many in his party, stands firm and decides to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. And he, this is the item that's on display in our case here, an 1888 version of the Emancipation Proclamation. Now, there are a couple of significant differences between the final January 1 version and that preliminary September 22nd version. First of all, not a word mentioned about compensation. Second, not a word about colonization. Not in there at all. And then he delineates in the document exactly where the emancipation is to take effect. And I, Abraham Lincoln, hereby say that the states are in armed rebellion under my powers as commander-in-chief, that he issues this proclamation. And he gives the states where it's going to be in effect. The states, the Confederacy, Tennessee's not on there, even though it was a seceded state, partly due to Andrew Johnson's influence. Arkansas, Texas, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina. Two states, Louisiana and Virginia, have major exceptions. The parishes here, 9 or 10 of them. In Virginia, 48 counties designated with West Virginia, in addition to several counties that are under Union military control. Again, the emancipation is not in effect in areas where the Union Army is overwhelming. This has led Bennett and historians ranging from Barbara Fields in the Ken Burns series, even those of us who were back 2 years ago at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library in Springfield, and their exhibits there, it leads, in my view, sloppy historians to claim that the Emancipation Proclamation, as issued on January 1, 1863, did not free a single soul. And to me, this is fallacious, and here's the reason why. If you look at the map of January 1863 to show where our military gains had taken place, there had been Union amphibious military invasions, the same one that David Hunter was in charge of, off of Fort Pulaski in Savannah here, off of Charleston, and in the Roanoke region of North Carolina. Union enclaves in which upwards of 10 to 15,000, by the stats I've been able to find, contraband slaves had flocked to Union lines. These slaves, ipso facto, by the terms of the Emancipation Proclamation, are freed directly on January 1, 1863. So those who claim the emancipation freed no one, I think, have their own disingenuous game and are trying to diminish Lincoln's accomplishment, because it clearly freed these slaves. And also, of course, ignores the fact and the impact on the remainder of the war. Every step a Union soldier would take further into the South, more slaves would flock to those Union troops. Those slaves under the provisions of the emancipation are immediately freed as soon as they come in contact with Union soldiers. So in my view, it's an oversight, a fallacious oversight, to claim that the emancipation freed no one. But most importantly, and here's really what I claim, in my view, to be the greatest of Lincoln's decisions, is a proviso that was in the final version of the Emancipation that's not in the preliminary version. And this is a simple sentence right here. And I further declare and make known that such persons of suitable condition shall be received in the armed service of the United States to garrison forts, position stations, and other places, and to man vessels of all sorts in said service. This one sentence authorizes the use of black soldiers, free or enslaved, as soldiers and sailors in the Union Armed Forces. Now again, this may seem like a no-brainer by our position today in the 21st century, but this was very controversial in 1863. He was getting a lot of opposition from people in the North, Democrats and Republicans alike, to this idea of using black soldiers. But Lincoln became convinced in this time period between September of 62, when he had that statement to the Chicago ministers, in January 63, that wartime requirements mandated that he use black soldiers, and there was a lot of opposition to that. All right, reaction in the North to the Emancipation Proclamation depended on your political party. Democrats, of course, were aghast. Union newspapers were in favor. This is the New South newspaper from Port Royal, South Carolina. This was an area that had been reconquered, one of these military enclaves. and they put out a newspaper. They declared, of course, as you can read here, one of the grandest victories of all time. This at any time, so they were, of course, positive. Reaction from the soldiers, the Union soldiers, was mixed. We have a manuscript in our holdings from Colonel John Snook of an Ohio regiment. And first of all, he believed that black soldiers were not going to be successful because the freed slaves were too fearful of their old masters to meet them in battle. And probably more importantly, I know Western troops, meaning Western Party of the United States, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, not our West, would not fight alongside them. In fact, there was some truth to this feeling. One entire regiment, the 109th Illinois, resigned en masse rather than suffer the indignity. Several Union officers resigned rather than suffer, in their view, the indignity of fighting alongside black men. So there was some impact on it, that negatively in the first few months of 1863. However, there were other soldiers, such as we also have in our manuscript holdings here at the Lincoln Shrine. Sylvester Kimball here feels the rebels are in a pickle about their slaves being set free, and they're trying in every way to come to terms. Now, he's probably a little too optimistic about the effect, but it did show that there were some Union soldiers who supported this idea and the thought that it would aid the Union war effort. Southern reaction, as you can imagine, was a little bit different. Jefferson Davis called it the most execrable document ever issued in the history of civilized man. And in particular, it was designed to foment slave rebellion. Now this engraving that we have in our collection here is from a German artist, Otto von Bohl. And here you see Lincoln penning the Emancipation Proclamation. He's got his foot on the U.S. Constitution, dipping his pen in the devil's inkwell. Buzzards are gathering outside here to prey on the bodies that surely would result, as resulted in Haiti, San Domingo, when they freed their slaves. There was rebellion and violence. So it was convinced that Lincoln was trying to incite servile insurrection, Nat Turner writ large, if you will, and then goad the slaves into rising up and murdering their masters. Now that did not happen, of course. European reaction was quite important. Up to the time of the Battle of Antietam, the British government under Lord Palmerston was on the verge of recognizing the Confederacy. And as we know from our own American Revolution, it was foreign recognition that really, and foreign support, that aided us in gaining our independence from Great Britain. So the Confederacy wanted to play the same game and get foreign recognition. Britain and France were on the verge of doing so right up to the time of Antietam and the Emancipation Proclamation. So that undercut support in Europe for the idea of recognizing the Confederacy. This is a cartoon from the London magazine Punch. And you can see a little bit of their bias toward the Confederacy. He looks like a more cavalier dandy sort of fellow, while Lincoln has horns on his hair. And he's throwing the ace of spades down upon the card table as the emancipation card, and the card table is gunpowder. In other words, they were very concerned as well that emancipation could lead directly to racial violence. All right, to bring our story to a conclusion, the proviso that was in the emancipation that I just pointed out about authorizing the use of black soldiers, in my view, is Lincoln's greatest decision. He was quickly validated in that by the performance of several black units in the summer of 1860. The most famous, of course, is the 54th Massachusetts of the movie Glory fame. And aside here, this is Robert Poole Shaw, Matthew Broderick, leading the assault. In reality, he is shot and killed and falls into the trench. The Hollywood producers thought that would be too dramatic, and no one would believe that. So in the movie version, he falls backwards and does not fall into the trench. The success of the 54th Massachusetts vindicated Lincoln's belief that black soldiers would be an essential part of the Union war effort. Despite that, there were plenty in the North, in the Republican Party, and in the Democratic Party as well, that wanted the Emancipation Proclamation rescinded. One of the people in the Republican Party in Illinois, James Conkling, wanted Lincoln to come to Illinois and give a speech saying he would rescind the Emancipation Proclamation. Lincoln refused to have anything to do with that. First of all, he didn't want to leave the capital during wartime, but he did draft a very long response known as the Conkling Letter, defending his Emancipation Proclamation. Now, several people have pointed out that the language in the Emancipation Proclamation itself is rather stilted and not inspiring, Lincoln being the great wordsmith on numerous occasions could inspire with his language. One historian calls it that it had all the moral grandeur of a bill of lading. Karl Marx in particular said it looked like a pettifogging lawyer's response to another lawyer's claim. Language in support of emancipation, and particularly for black troops, is found in this Conkling letter. Doris Kearns Goodwin, when she was out here a couple of years ago, believes that this is the after the Second Inaugural, and the Gettysburg Address, the third most important and eloquent document that Lincoln ever wrote, his response back to James Conklin. Now, so several of you shaking your heads, you know the story. We have in our holdings here, those of you who don't know the story, a little-known third copy of that Conklin letter. Ben Field was a Republican operative in New York. He got wind of the fact that Lincoln was writing a written response about the Emancipation Proclamation to Conklin. He asked Lincoln for a copy for his Republican gathering in upstate New York. Lincoln responds with this brief note to Ben Field. Here's a copy of the Springfield letter. Do not let it become public until your meeting shall have come off, or perhaps I shall say, come on. In the 19th century idiom we don't quite pick up today. But Ben Field's nephew, Kirk Hartfield, was a prominent Redlands pioneer and would be prominent in the founding and work at Smiley Public Library. Ben Field gave this manuscript to Hartfield, who gave it to Robert Washburn, our founder, that ended up in our collection of Lincoln Memorial Shrine. Again, one of the more prominent documents he ever wrote. Now, Lincoln, in this eight-page response, eloquently lays out his rationale. Rationale for the use of black soldiers. So if you'll bear with me, I want to quote directly from Lincoln's words. But to be plain, you are dissatisfied with me about the Negro. Quite likely there is a difference of opinion between you and myself upon that subject. I certainly wish that all men could be free, while I suppose you do not. Yet I have neither adopted nor proposed any measure which is not consistent with even your view, provided you are for the Union. I suggested compensated emancipation, to which you replied you wished not to be taxed to buy Negroes. But I had not asked you to be taxed to buy Negroes, except in such a way as to save you from the greater taxation to save the Union exclusively by other means. You dislike the Emancipation Proclamation, and perhaps would have it retracted. You say it is unconstitutional. I think differently. I think the Constitution invests in its Commander-in-Chief with the law of war in time of war. You say you will not fight to free Negroes. Some of them seem willing to fight for you. But no matter, fight you then exclusively to save the Union. I issued the proclamation on purpose to aid you in saving the Union. Whenever you shall have conquered all resistance to the Union, if I shall urge you then to continue fighting, it will be apt time for you to declare that you will not fight the free Negroes. I thought in that your struggle with the Union, to whatever extent the Negroes should cease helping the enemy, to that extent it weakened the enemy in his resistance to you. Do you think differently? I thought that whatever Negroes can be taught to do as soldiers leaves just so much less for white soldiers to do in saving the Union. Does it appear otherwise to you? But Negroes, like other people, act upon motives. Why should they do anything for us if we will do nothing for them? If they stake their lives for us, they must be prompted by the strongest motive, even the promise of freedom. And the promise being made must be kept. Peace does not appear as so distant as it did. I hope it will come soon and come this day, and so come as to be worth the keeping in all future time. It will then have been proved that among free men there can be no successful appeal from the ballot to the bullet, and that those who take such appeal are sure to lose their case and pay the cost. And then there will be some black men who can remember that with silent tongue and clenched teeth and steady eye and well-poised bayonet, they have helped mankind on to this great consummation. While I fear there will be some white ones, unable to forget, with malignant heart and deceitful speech, they have strove to hinder it. There's a key line here, the well-poised bayonet that Lincoln was speaking of. Again, in this summation of Lincoln's attitudes towards the use of black soldiers, you can see how he has moved, how he has grown, how he has changed from the Lincoln whose words we read in 1858, or even just a few months before this in 1862. It was the demonstration of black courage on the battlefield that changed Lincoln's viewpoints. Now, for the remainder of the Civil War, in places like Honey Springs, Fort Hudson, Alusty, and Petersburg, black soldiers would make the difference in the Civil War. 200,000 would serve, 30,000 would die before the result was open. Lincoln would give them credit for tilting the balance in favor of the Union. And more importantly, at the last speech that Lincoln would ever make in April of 1865, Lincoln informed an audience, a racially mixed audience, outside the White House in April 1865, that he was in favor now of limited voting rights for very intelligent Negroes and for the men who served in our armed forces. That would be the last speech that Lincoln would make. John Wilkes Booth would hear that speech that night, turn to a colleague and said, "Damn him, that means enter citizenship." That's the last speech he'll ever make. And it was the last speech he ever made. So Lincoln's progress, his path on emancipation, sees a man who was a man of his time, I think a man of 1850s Illinois, a racist by our standards today, but he progressed. His key wartime decision to include black soldiers in the Emancipation Proclamation ironically led to further growth and allowed him to make the statements later in his life that would help realize the goal of turning America into a multiracial democracy. Thank you for your attention.